Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom in crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to the Savvy Shrink. Welcome to the Savvy Shrink. I'm honored today to have our guest, Walker Ladd. Dr. Walker Ladd is the Associate University Research Chair for the Center for Health Engineering Research. Dr. Ladd also serves as the group leader for the Health Engineering Research's Special Interest Group, Mental Health and Psychological Well-being Research Community. She is a leader also for the Grounded Theory section of the Research Methodology Special Interest Group. Dr. Ladd is university research methodologist and teaches qualitative research methods and year two residency for the School of Advanced Studies. Dr. Ladd has been a thought leader in the field of maternal health care for over a decade. She has been recognized for her research and leadership in the field of perinatal psychology, trauma research, and post-traumatic growth. Her first book, Transformed by Postpartum Depression, Women's Stories of Trauma and Growth, was based on her grounded theory study of the transformative nature of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. Dr. Ladd served as a research fellow for the Center for Leadership Studies and Educational Research, where she published a grounded theory study regarding successful scholarly publication for mid-career faculty, co-authored by Dr. Mark McCaslin. She has been published by the American Psychological Association, the Huffington Post, Science and Sensibility, the American College of Nurse Midwives, and the Integral Leadership Review. Dr. Ladd's current research includes her serving as principal investigator on a grounded theory study of the stigma of mental illness for new mothers diagnosed with bipolar disorder. She is currently working on her second book, When Postpartum Depression Grows Up, Reflecting, Researching, Reclaiming, a heuristic synthesis of quantitative and qualitative data regarding how mothers of older children reflect on the experience of having had a perinatal mood or anxiety disorder. Dr. Ladd has two children and is a 14-year breast cancer survivor. Welcome, Dr. Walker Ladd.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you here. Thank you for sharing this time.
My goodness, thank you for that long introduction. I appreciate it so much, and thank you for the invitation to come in and be a part of the podcast.
It's an honor. It's truly an honor to have you here. Thank you for sharing this time and your expertise, and you're involved in so much great research and literature writing, and it's just an honor to have you here. And we'd love to hear if you could share with us our listeners what your current research is focused on and how we can learn about it.
Sure. As you said at the beginning, I'm working on two projects, one of which is my study on the stigma of bipolar disorder for moms who received that diagnosis in the first year postpartum. So I just received a grant to complete that study. And I'm really, you know, it's a double-edged sword because I want to say that I'm excited. Mm-hmm. But I'm also saddened because I've already done the data collection and I'm in the last part of analysis. And I'm saddened because of what the data shows me. And that is that of the women that I interviewed, I had a final sample of 15.
Okay.
And their experience across the board was, again, something that I saw in my earlier research. Began with the provider and their care provider not being either informed or having access to the current literature. regarding bipolar disorder. So all of them ended up incredibly sick before they were treated. And then many of them were not treated correctly. And even more was this experience of when they got the diagnosis, it came with some sort of qualifier or affect from the provider that made them feel that it was really bad. Mm-hmm. For instance, one woman shared that during her hospitalization, she finally got her diagnosis from a LCSW social worker at the hospital who was looking at her chart and saw the diagnosis and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." So that's the beginning of their experience with the diagnosis. And then, as we all know, then their experience is being launched into a world where kind of the stereotypes that we all have had interaction with come to life. And finally, what the last part of the study's starting to look like is that, like we all know and have experienced ourselves, I'm seeing that these women had to develop strategies to figure out who to tell and who not to tell.
Right. Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
If they had a choice, they wouldn't tell anybody. Or in a perfect world, they'd tell everyone.
Very interesting. Very interesting. It's so important that you're doing this research because of such profound stigma. And I think it's just groundbreaking work that you're involved in, and so important because, as we know, it's perinatal mood and anxiety disorders are the most pronounced complication, most common complication of pregnancy and childbirth. And what better area to focus on in research than this particular area? So I think women have such a hard time with the stigma piece as well. And
And you know, the other thing that I do see a similarity between the work that I did with postpartum moms who didn't, my first book was about moms who had been diagnosed with depression. The difference between those women and these women is that the nature of the illness for bipolar disorder is chronic. It's a chronic lifetime illness that they have to manage.
Right.
And for all of them, managing an illness along with managing motherhood, it becomes their responsibility. And how often they're the ones to educate their providers or their para-providers, like the pharmacists.
Right. It's absolutely so true. It's when we're dealing with a diagnosis that's a more chronic, long-term situation, it is definitely a challenge, to say the least, for moms that are trying to heal in the aftermath of giving birth and raising a family, et cetera, et cetera. But then to also be managing bipolar disorder. How challenging is that? That's incredible.
One last thing that I did want to share is that part of why I love what I do is that when all of this data comes in, and for example, I had 5 of the 16 women say nearly verbatim the same thing about a stereotype of being bipolar. And that was that they experienced someone believing that if you're bipolar, you are running down the street screaming and naked. Exactly. And that stereotype is there. I mean, I had 2 women from Canada and the women from all over the United States. So it becomes so important to understand their experience so that they can inform us what we need to know.
I think you're
and
so
what we need
on.
To unknow.
For sure. And they're really the drivers of educating everyone about what it's like to the patient is to experience what it's like with bipolar experience after giving birth to a child or while pregnant. There's such stigma involved. And so I think the research you're doing is incredibly helpful. And it's so wonderful that you're able to have these conversations with women who are living this, and that can help everyone else sort of dismantle the misconceptions of what this is. And you know, we get so many pieces of misinformation on media, so we're confused. I think a lot of people are confused about what perinatal depression is or what postpartum bipolar disorder is or what have you. And education is absolutely the first step. So I think these women are very courageous to be able to share their stories. And I think it's fantastic that you're working with them and doing the research to help lend a voice to understanding this.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. With that, we would love to hear more about why research is so important for maternal mental health populations, and how can people learn to discern what is good research versus that which is fake?
Well, first of all, I think, I don't know that these go in any order of, of import, because they're all important.
Sure.
You know, around the birth period is a period of a woman's life where she has more direct contact with medical care providers than probably any other time in her life. Mm-hmm. On an ongoing basis, there's a continuum of care with at least a practice of people, nurses, obstetric providers, etc. So when women are in that period of life, we're being given knowledge from our medical providers that's based in, hopefully, scientific medical research. And in order to be able to discern it, to question it, to suggest alternatives, it's vitally important that women feel empowered to know the difference between current research and research that might be outdated, just so that they can have that kind of advocacy for themselves with provider. Also, not having access or understanding research may and does impact our behaviors with regards to the care that we may or may not engage in the perinatal period.
Absolutely.
So, for example, for a long time there was and continues to be, but I think it's dying down, the idea of placentophagia. Mm-hmm. And while that gained some sort of life, some sort of, it was alive and functioning in the social media and in some paraprofessional worlds like postpartum doulas, not all, but some. That's an example of, without knowledge of good research, somebody who's really needing assessment and treatment from a medical provider for a perinatal mood disorder might choose to do placentophagia in lieu of other treatment options.
Good point. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, may suffer, may get sicker, may, not to mention there are side effects that are not necessarily all known about doing placentophagia. So
placentophagia meaning eating the placenta or getting it encapsulated. And so sometimes these news outlets and social media might point to something that could be a possibility, but isn't necessarily evidence-based, correct?
Correct. Okay. And when you think about it, you know, especially for the Western world, pregnant mothers, pregnant women are consuming information at light speed. And if you're consuming information that's either wrong or misleading or not thorough, and you change your behaviors regarding even vitamin intake or food intake or exposure to teratogens, you're developing your fetus, your baby during that period. So let's just say that it becomes out on Facebook and the social sphere. There's some sort of an idea that, I don't know, drinking tea can increase your baby's IQ. And then everybody starts drinking tea.
Right.
Without the knowledge of, okay, what kind of tea? And 9 times out of 10, Andrea, it isn't founded in evidence-based knowledge. So even providers are guilty of this. And my hope is that if we can increase our research literacy for everyone, that we can start making better decisions for ourselves and for the people that we serve. And there's a huge difference between health news and health science.
Absolutely. I think you make a very important point. And part of it is important for the reader actually to have the discernment to really look at where that news source is coming from. And I think further on in our conversation, if you could also illuminate where can people find really mm-hmm. evidence-based, solid information about good research versus that which might be a fad.
Yeah, and I teach the following three ideas about having a kind of a good scientific mind, and that is that you're skeptical, mm-hmm. that you're curious, and that you're humble. Mm. So with those three things, you carry them towards what you're given, and you have to make choices. So in preparation for today, I wanted to share an organization that gets it really right.
Great.
And that's Mother to Baby.
Mother to Baby.
.org.
.org. Okay.
What they do, you mm-hmm. know, they started as a very kind of technical, they look at the effect of over-the-counter and mm-hmm. prescribed and environmental toxins on the developing baby.
Oh, wow.
And they've mentioned that if the listeners go, they will see that you can chat mm-hmm. with somebody who's trained in this. You can get PDF downloads. You can, if you're a professional, you can chat. What I used to advocate for doulas is that they would go with moms to the site and say, all right, let's chat with one of these live people at UCSD.
Fabulous.
And see, fabulous. And let's look at your concern about the amount of Tylenol that you want to take at night. Uh-huh. And then women themselves get the information that's from scientific organizations. So I think that for the maternal population, at least for the childbearing population, is one.
Yes.
And yes. For providers on a larger scope, I recommend the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
So many wonderful, and they're very generous, these organizations. And the CDC and the World Health Organization, there are infographics and data that is available that's accurate, up to date, understandable, and informative.
Wonderful. That's so helpful to
hear. I think also I think part of why I get so passionate about this is that for so long, like since the beginning, Hippocrates in my wandering womb, we've been told what is happening with our bodies and our minds. And research is not just for folks who have PhDs and MDs. It's something that we all can engage in, look at, understand, and use.
Correct.
To better our lives. Correct. And to help those around us. It just, you know, it's kind of that academia thing is not just for academics. We need to make it more consumer-based mom-based, you know?
Absolutely.
There are, along with the organizations and the resources that are available, are probably 10 times organizations and resources that are not helpful. But because we are becoming more aware of maternal mental health, we're eager to help and we're eager to share what worked for us. That's not always helpful in terms of treatment. So being able to discern between support and science is incredibly important. And there's a difference. And
absolutely.
Being able to
absolutely.
Walk into your provider with data from, you know, a handout that you can easily now get from Mother to Baby that says, you know, doctor, here are the current risks mm-hmm. about taking antidepressants during my pregnancy. And based on what this shows, I'm good to go. And you hand that to your doctor, you begin a conversation with a care provider that's informed.
Excellent.
Rather than a friend of mine on Facebook said that she took Zoloft and she, you know, was miserable. So it's that anecdotal versus the science.
I think that's such a good point.
I also feel very strongly that it's everyone's responsibility.
Yes.
All of the advocates, the mental health care providers, the doulas, the nurses, the family members. To use good information, especially in any clinical setting or any mental health setting. You know, those folks have the responsibility to stay up on the research too.
They do.
And one of the things that I think you wanted me to talk about was about reducing stigma. And
yes.
The model of stigma that I like is Graham Thornycroft's. And he's a stigma researcher in the UK. And he says there are three components. The first is ignorance. And it's not like a person doesn't have a good IQ. It's that what starts stigma is a lack of knowledge about the subject. From that lack of knowledge, we as human beings tend to agree to believe in assumptions about that experience. So for maternal mental health, the lack of knowledge about, I'll use my recent study, the lack of knowledge about bipolar disorders in the perinatal period, that ignorance led to prejudicial beliefs and assumptions about how the woman was acting. For instance, the first 3 days postpartum is known to be kind of a prevalent onset of early signs of mania. So if you're holding ignorance or you're holding lack of information as a provider, and you don't know that woman's family history, and you don't know to ask her mental health history, your prejudice will be that her behavior day four, as you check her out of the hospital, is that she's not exhibiting signs of early mania. And what happens after the prejudice phase in Thornycroft's model is then discrimination happens. And discrimination is the behavior that we do that somehow separates normal from abnormal.
Okay.
Those behaviors can be anything from discharging somebody because you don't know how to follow through on the ideas or the principles that there might be perinatal mood disorders that need to be addressed pre-discharge. Or, in my study, was the common experience that women had at their places of employment. So you take a mom who has to go, first of all, she hasn't been screened or treated correctly. She ends up getting so sick that she's got to go into the hospital maybe more than once. And so she has to go to her employer and say, I need time off. And very often HR will say, okay, so this is a medical leave, and what is the nature of that medical leave? And if they share that it's a mental illness, a lot of these women, when they return to work, experience discrimination, either tacit or overt. Their hours were cut, the level of work was diminished, so they were given easy stuff. So this is part of how I hope. You know, it's all connected. If we can increase our knowledge, we can decrease our prejudicial beliefs about mental illness and not engage in discriminatory behavior.
I think that's fantastic words of wisdom. Do you think we're making any progress?
That depends on how you define progress. I mean, I would have said yes prior to our recent election.
Oh.
I mean, not just honestly. I sense the progress is not necessarily progressing, but I could be wrong, and that's my bias.
I hear you.
I do think that there are, I know for a fact that there are amazing researchers looking at the development of all kinds of wonderful interventions, you know, biomedical interventions, but I don't think we're making any progress when it comes to moms who are older.
That's a problem.
And that's kind of the point of my current book.
Fantastic. Tell us more about that.
I've already done a lot of the data collection. You know, we don't have either scientific knowledge or even literature that's about the lived experience of being a mom who had perinatal mood disorder or anxiety disorder. And you have a 10, 12, 15, 27-year-old. There's part of the myth, I don't want to say it's a complete myth, but there is some sort of golden idea that all of postpartum goes away. And that's just not true. The symptoms get better. Sometimes the symptoms go away with treatment, but the experience is always there. So I'm interested in looking at how women who do have this experience and how they feel about it, how they remember it specifically. And if their views of themselves have changed, if they're, and how, I think the number one thing that's driving me in this work is how, I didn't see this coming, Andrea, is how women talk about the love they have for that child is so amazing. I mean, I get chills and start to tear up because I started with a survey, 126 women, and one of the questions was, how would you describe the love you have for your child with whom you had PPD or PMAD? And the words are boundless, amazing, overwhelming. They're all the sense of so deep, so far, so broad. That love for that child is very special. And to go even further, they started describing that it was a connection with the child with whom they had their illness that was almost empathic. That they knew that child knew them, that they knew that there was a connection and a comfort and a co-knowledge with that child that was not like anything else that they knew or had
That's
known.
Beautiful. That's beautiful to uncover that.
So, yeah, I'm doing a different kind of research with the book, and heuristic research, you get to talk about, you're asked to talk about your own experience. So I'm pulling in. I always think that research is always about ourselves, but with heuristics, you get permission to do it. And I'm talking a lot, pulling in a lot about my own experience.
Which is so helpful. And they're not alone.
And that there's this kind of wisdom of weathering the storms. I mean, I've interviewed moms for my book, and some are weary, some are tired, some are destroyed, but no matter how difficult raising a child or children, how difficult it has been, they always come back to this connection with that child.
Right. Such a special bond. That is helpful.
I did want to do is to pull readers in during the research process. So I'm kind of sharing as I go along with what I'm doing and looking to integrate all of this in a creative way. And that creative product will hopefully be the book. I mean, yesterday I posted a song that my son just composed. And my son, Ziggy, is the child with whom I had postpartum depression. He's getting ready to turn 17. And this past 2 years have been incredibly difficult because of an unexpected divorce. And the nature of our relationship has changed through circumstances. I mean, just living apart from your children is gut-wrenching.
Absolutely.
And he wrote this song that totally fits what the experience of the data that I have for all of these women who are connected to give themselves a break. And Ziggy's not even aware of the research I'm doing, much less reading it. But it fit. It fit. So
that's fantastic.
I'm excited about that.
There's a lot of congruency there.
Yes.
That's fabulous. Well, I'm just so impressed with what you're doing.
When I talk to people, it's always have the set of symptoms on your notepad before you go and say, okay, doctor, I have not been sleeping for this period of time. I've lost my ability to feel excited about my job or my book club or my friends. I'm not eating the way I should be, to literally just kind of go down the symptoms and ask them to treat you.
Yes.
And that's sometimes medication and sometimes not. Medication is not a cure. It's a treatment. And probably I would say try to find the resources, if it's possible, to go to somebody who knows about this to talk to them. That could be a faith-based counselor, could be a support group, but somebody who's not necessarily right in the middle of their lives, somebody who's trained to work with them as a therapist or counselor.
Absolutely.
Hold confidentiality and walk them through the process.
I think it's an excellent point.
I'm not sure that the book will end up with this title, but it's where it's the landing spot for my work right now, and that's When PPD Grows Up.
Okay.
And that's about my book. And then the work that I'm doing at the University of Phoenix with the health, in running the health research centers there, is very exciting and very interesting. I talk about that a lot on LinkedIn, and I have a social media presence on in terms of Facebook, but I don't really want to, you know, not practice what I preach.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, don't go to my Facebook to find information about something that's very serious. So I, you know what I mean?
I hear you. You have such humility.
You just have to. And my first book's on Amazon and Proclaris Press.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing.
I think you're doing fabulous work.
And thank you. So I think you are too.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing this time with us.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you, Walker.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.